Accession number 16395, rail 6.
Crookenden, rail 6. The postcard read, "My dear Arthur, I saw your boy today with his battalion, full stop. They were in good nick. Yours ever, Montgomery of Alamein." Two things struck me then and now. How good of Monty to take the trouble to write to my father, a retired colonel living in Berkshire, when he was running a gigantic army group crossing on the Rhine. And secondly, to a man he'd known for 30 years, to address him as "My dear Arthur," and then sign it "Montgomery of Alamein." Well, so we sat there for another day, and then the great advance across Germany started. Most of the way, 6th Airborne Division and our 3rd Parachute Brigade, and in it my 9th Parachute Battalion, went most of the way on our feet. We had, of course, no transport on landing. Soon after landing, I had 2 farm carts for my mortars. I had some of the machine guns moving in prams we'd liberated from various farms and villages. And I ended up with a very fine Mercedes-Benz Tourer, one of those cars with great brass tubes coming out of the engine. The division had also landed on the Rhine some American light tanks called locust tanks with a very small gun, totally useless in battle, and usually suffering high casualties. My soldiers came all over the army, and I had several men from the Royal Tank Regiment who'd volunteered for parachuting, and 3 of these now found one of these tanks abandoned in a wood, took it over, and for another week or two we trundled across Germany with this American light tank as part of our motor transport. The next few weeks until the end of the war in Europe in May, we had the occasional skirmish with Germans, which probably the most tragic was a village of Recklinghausen, which we cleared without any real problem. It was occupied by Germans. But one farm and one big barn in that farm held out, and we weren't prepared to risk a lot of casualties for no purpose. So I told the companies concerned to touch it off. And once it was burning fiercely, 3 figures came dashing out of the barn door, firing as they came, and were cut down by my people, our people. And they were 3 boys of about 15, dressed as soldiers and firing machine guns. We felt rather brutal, because they were prepared to shoot us. There were many other minor incidents all the way through Germany. But perhaps the most unusual was the end of that phase of our war. We crossed the Elbe by bridge, not by dropping or anything, just on our feet. We moved into a village which we later discovered was held by an ear, nose and throat battalion, a battalion of Germans emptied from a hospital, all sick, and they quite rightly surrendered almost as soon as you looked at them. And then we paused for the night. Our original crossing of the Rhine some weeks before, the 2 airborne divisions, British and American, had been commanded by General Matthew B. Ridgway, a famous American general who later turned round the American army in Korea, transformed them from a defeated rabble into a victorious army, a very fine soldier. We came back under his command for this final phase. He came into our brigade headquarters that evening after crossing the Elbe, and a tall, soldierly figure, always wearing full rifleman's equipment, two grenades strapped to his shoulder straps. And we all stood up, and he, I remember, said, "Be at ease, gentlemen, be at ease, sit down," and told us, and our brigadier, of course, that our job was to get in trucks this time, not walk, drive like hell to the Baltic coast, about 70 miles away, and forestall the Russians, whose armored divisions under Field Marshal Rokossovsky were racing westwards along the Baltic coast, aiming for Norway, aiming for Denmark. So we were piled into three-ton trucks. We were given a squadron of the Scots Greys, Sherman tanks, to go with us. And we started racing across the German countryside. Halfway towards the coast, we suddenly realized that the stream of refugees, German civilians, instead of moving away eastwards in front of us, were all moving back westwards and cheering us. And we soon realized, of course, that we were the liberators, the saviors from the advancing Russians. We got into the seaport town of Wismar, our main objective, and half an hour later, the first Russian patrol, an armored car with a young officer in it, entered the town from the east and found it, of course, it blocked off by us. We were disposed in battle positions all around the town. One of our three parachute battalions was a Canadian. They were facing east, and I was facing south, and 8th battalion facing west. And I went forward to see the eastern sector and the Canadians just after this patrol had arrived. And there was General Bowles, our divisional commander, who'd taken over from General Gale some months before. And he urgently wanted somebody to go out eastwards, find a senior Russian officer, and bring him in to parley to arrange all the difficult business of two armies meeting each other in water. And I was standing at the back with my truck, so I made some signs, you know. And Eric Bowles said, "Right, Napier, take your truck, go out to the east and find me a Russian general." And I took with me from the Canadian battalion one of their Dukhobors, as you probably know, who are Russian speaking and living British Columbia, a sergeant, fluent Russian. I got a sheet out of one of the local houses, and with my driver's private Sayers and my Canadian Dukhobor, set off to the east. Everything totally deserted, no sign of traffic, people, a few cattle, nothing else. And after 10 miles of empty countryside, we saw around the next bend, or on the next bend, a great long barrel of a Russian tank looking at us. So I furiously waved the white sheet out of the window. Sayers slowed down our truck. And there was this little group of Russians, tank crews, on the side of the road. And we had a tremendous meeting, and everybody kissed each other, and so on. And I said through my interpreter, "Where's your general?" And as I said that, a troop of tanks came down the road, I thought very high speed, covered in infantry, and the leading tank flying a great big red flag. And in the afternoon light, it looked very impressive, a picture of tanks at speed rushing through an enemy countryside. And we eventually, after a luckle-wackle bargle, we found a senior officer. I put him in my car and pursued this group of tanks. They were going, I suppose, 30 or something of that sort. But Private Sayers, who's a very good driver, I said, "Must pass them." So at rather high speed, and very often in or out of the ditch each side, he passed these tanks. And the Russian senior officer, he was some sort of general, I think, beside me, kept on gripping him by the arm. He was so nervous of Private Sayers driving, which I thought was rather pleasing. we came into Wismar. It was getting dark then. The Canadians were lined up, had blocked all the roads, and the anti-tank guns pointing at the Russians. The tank stopped. I got this Russian out, went into the divisional headquarters, a house they'd established temporarily, and Eric Bowles, General Bowles, and the Russian, and then his staff had reached us after that, had a long talk. And although I didn't know at the time what they were saying, what the Russian was saying, we were told almost at once, the Russian was cursing Eric Bowles quite rudely and saying, I have behind me a whole armored regiment. My objective is Copenhagen. You are in my way. Out of the way. And Eric, who had a very long day, not rather tired, lost his temper after we'd been talking for about an hour, and said to his interpreter, tell this useless oaf, if he is not back 1 mile from my outposts inside 1 hour, I shall open fire. And I have with me a complete division. I have an Army Group Royal Artillery of 250 guns. So, then a question of who's the strongest. I am. Get back now. And straight away the Russian gave a great smile. He'd had several whiskies. And said, at once, General. He read the form. And of course that's the way that they understand. And they went back. We had no more trouble. Now, 2 days later, was it three? I can't remember the exact days. VE Day was announced, the end of the war in Europe. We had the town of Wismar, a big town, packed with 1 million wounded and refugees, masses and masses of women and girls of all sorts. You could have anyone for a pack of cigarettes. Complete breakdown in law and order. Rule of law disappeared. Civilian looting going on all over the town. And rather rashly, we opened the town to the Russians. Now, the Russian tank regiment, who was actually I'd met and were closest to the town, the officers were all European Russians. Nearly all the men were these people, were Tartars, slit-eyed Mongolians. And the first Russian truck was a half-track, built, oddly enough, in America, a Diamond T half-track. It drove down the main street of Wismar in the morning, picked up a girl off the street, all raped her in the back of a truck, shot her in the stomach, and threw her out of the truck. Well, we blocked that truck. Our own brigade patrols blocked it before it could turn around. We tied them up in ropes and threw them back over the line to the Russians. And I was sent out again with my Dukhobor, a Dukhobor interpreter. I saw the Russian commanding officer of the tank battalion, a handsome, tall, sort of handsome-looking, typical Russian of a certain sort, and complained and said, we are not animals. The war is over. The town is closed to all your troops. I'd less ever have themselves. And he looked at me again through his interpreter and said, I have led this regiment, or bits of it, right away in the south in the Stalingrad campaign. I brought it up, joined Rokossovsky's armies in the north of Russia. And I've come all the way through East Prussia, along the Baltic coast, and throughout my time in Western Russia, we have not found a single living Russian civilian. In my regiment, I have given orders that murder, rape, loot, and arson are legal. These people are not human. So I said, well, I'm terribly sorry, but that's wartime. The war is now ended. maybe only yesterday. And if your troops want to come into our town, they behave. He said, didn't say anything, actually. I walked out. And they did behave after that. But we arrived in that town. We met the Russians. Every one of my battalion, including all the officers and everybody, we thought the Red Army were marvelous. We greatly admired their terrific feat in smashing so much of the German army. And we were staggered by the way they treated Germans. But of course, thinking about it for a second, you realize it was because of the way the Germans had treated them. Not only in World War II, but probably for 1,000 years before. The great hatred between Teuton and Slav. An indication of that atmosphere was the German hospital train, which from the Eastern Front, a day or two before we arrived in the town, had been run into the railway siding leading down to Wismar Port near the docks, and it was packed with German wounded from the Eastern Front. Now, on that night, contact with the Russians, we couldn't patrol anywhere, you can't keep them out. And a Russian patrol had found this train, stopped up a few nurses, shot a few doctors. And the next day, our own field ambulance, our own medical people, were told to clear the train, deal with it. And they found, to their astonishment, that there were no German army medical personnel left on the train. Very unlike them. They'd left their wounded. And such was the terror of the Russians that the station approach, the siding approach, a road running down to the docks, which led westward, was full of wounded hopping and crawling and staggering westwards to escape the Russians. And then 3 days, was it 4 days later, we were told to return to England. Don't forget, Wismar is 30 or 40 miles inside the Potsdam line, part of the future East Germany. I still spoke fluent German. And my adjutant, Frankie Taverner, came in on the last two or three mornings in Wismar before we left. He said, there's a lady here, a German lady, wants to seek you, sir. So I said, show her in. And this was the owner of a very large and handsome house in the suburbs, which was the billet, or one of the billets, for my B company. And I thought she was going to come and complain about B company's behavior or something. And she said to me, is it true that you are leaving this town shortly and that this is going to be part of the Russian zone of occupation? I said, I really can't tell you, madam. I'm just a soldier. And I can't tell you what our movements are. And she said, thank you very much. Said no more, turned about, went out, went straight home. And the top floors of the house had been left to her family. Shot her two teenage daughters and herself, rather than remain there in the Russian zone. And there were suicides all over the town that night. I mean, the terror of those two races, mutual terror, is something in England we can't begin to understand. So we went by truck down to an airfield, emplaned in Dakota aircraft, and flew back to another Raven, nearest airfield to our own barracks. And that was the end of our war in Europe.
Can we jump ahead to the Malayan emergency now, please, when you had a staff job there, I think, in the 50s?
Yes, okay. Just collect my thoughts. Go. In 1952, I was a lieutenant colonel and had been teaching at the School of Landa Warfare, a joint service school on air support and air transport at Aerosarum near Salisbury. I was posted in February that year to Malaya to take over as chairman of the Combined Emergency Planning Staff in the Director of Operations Headquarters at Bluff Road, Kuala Lumpur. Field Marshal Templer, or General Templer as he then was, had been recently made High Commissioner and Director of Operations. And so for the first time in the Malayan emergency, had complete control of an appointed legislative assembly and was overall commander of the police, the army, the air force and the navy. In my CEPS, as it was called, Combined Emergency Planning Staff, I was a soldier. We had an airman, Wing Commander Lloyd Joel. We had a civil servant and a policeman called Peter Andrews. All the other three were able and effective, fairly young members of their respective service. And our job was to ferret out for Field Marshal Templer the detail, the background of any problem which he thought needed solving. Thanks to that very able man, General Briggs, who had thought up the principle of defeating the communists in the jungle, the principle of first resettling all the Chinese squatters on the jungle fringe into properly organized new villages, properly provided with land protection and wire fencing. Secondly, to institute strict food control throughout Malaya so that the Chinese communists coming into the Chinese villages in the night and demanding food off them, could be told rightly by each village there isn't any. We've only got barely enough for ourselves. And thirdly, deep penetration of the jungle by the army and the police. An example of what I mean is General Templer leaping from his hot bath or waking up in the morning and come to the conclusion that he was dissatisfied with the anti-communist operations going on in one of the states. Take Johor. In each state, there was the Sultan, of course. There was a British advisor, a type of ambassador. There was a chief police officer. And there was an army brigadier. And in each state, there were two, three, or four battalions operating in the jungle against the Chinese terrorists. In each state, there was a state war executive committee with the heads of the different services who discussed all operations and measures taken against communism and the Chinese communists. And similarly, at Kuala Lumpur, the capital, every Monday, Templer presided over the Central War Executive Committee, his war cabinet, with the GOC, the Army, the Air Marshal, and the Chief Secretary, and so on. He would then send for me, or he had a Chief of Staff too, a Major General, called Bill Oliver, highly efficient and charming person, either through Bill Oliver or sometimes direct to me, the sort of chairman or leader of his Planners, and he would say, go down to Johor and don't come back till you find out why they're not killing any Chinese communists. And as we were his men, we had carte blanche on any form of travel, aircraft, helicopters, trucks, railway, anything. We could go where we liked, when we liked, and how we liked. We would then go down to Johor. We'd attend a meeting of the State War Executive Committee. We'd persuade them that we were there on Temple's behalf, not as his spies, to check on what they were doing, but to make helpful recommendations to how central government could help them in the fight against Chinese communism. Sometimes this was difficult, depending on the character of the British advisor or the brigadier. In Johor, they were quite pleased to see us. We then go around, as we did in every state, the CO of the army in that state. And within each state, there were further subdivisions called police circles or police districts. In each district, a battalion, a senior district officer, usually British, sometimes Malay, not often, and a CO of the battalion. We go around each, say, half a dozen of these districts in Johor. We discuss with them all their problems. And then we'd come back, sit down, and write out a 40-page document. What to do in Johor? We'd end up with 30 or 40 recommendations, operations in the jungle, out of it, road control, resettlement, police, intelligence, all that. And then we had to go back to Johor, all done in for a day or two, show it to the authorities there, and they couldn't change what we'd written, but they, if we'd misrepresented them or criticized them, they had the right, that we had to include their counterblast or their criticism of us. And then the following Friday or Saturday, we'd give it in to Templar's immediate personal staff. He would look through it. On Monday afternoon, he would have his central war executive committee, his war cabinet. He'd go through the whole thing with them. And by the end of that meeting, our 40 recommendations, he'd have agreed, say, 25 of them, scrub 10, and left 5 out for the moment. And the next day, Tuesday, the rest of our staff, the director of operations staff, would write out the orders to the ground, and the third day they'd be operating. I mean, rapid executive government. We got into fearful hot water sometimes with people on the ground, brigadiers and others who thought we were jumped up a lot of cocky young officers. But generally speaking, we had very good support, and always excellent support from Templar himself. It was a most enjoyable and fascinating time because you felt you were doing something useful. And of course, we saw, the four of us, we saw every single kampong, village, town in Malaya. Sadly, it only lasted 2 years, and he went home, and I went home too.
Were you ever in any danger?
No. The press at home gave the impression we all sat cowering in our bungalows. My bungalow was as close to the jungle as our wood there. But we never had any problem. I never understood, actually,